Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 33, The Four Burials of Joseph Warren. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about Dr. Joseph Warren, a key figure in the Patriot cause whose many accomplishments led the Royal Governor of Massachusetts, General Thomas Gage, to remark that the death of Joseph Warren is akin to the death of 500 patriots. He was so in demand that his body was moved three times after his death at the Battle of Bunker Hill. But before we talk rabble-rousing and grave-digging, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is June 19th, and on June 19th, 1776, a British officer wrote to General William Howe explaining and apologizing for his capture by the Americans. "Sir, I am sorry to inform you that it has been my unfortunate lot to have fallen into the hands of the Americans in the middle of Boston Harbor. But when the circumstances which have occasioned this disaster are understood, I flatter myself no reflection will arise to myself or my officers on account of it. On the 16th of June, the George and Annabella transports, with two companies of the 71st Regiment of Highlanders, made the land off Cape Ann, after a passage of 7 weeks from Scotland, during the course of which we had not the opportunity of speaking to a single vessel that could give us the smallest information of the British troops having evacuated Boston. On the 17th, at daylight, we found ourselves opposite to the harbor's mouth at Boston, but from contrary winds, it was necessary to make several tacks to reach it. Four schooners, which we took to be pilots or armed vessels in the service of His Majesty, but which were afterwards found to be American privateers, were bearing down upon us at 4 o'clock in the morning. As my orders were for port of Boston, I thought it my duty, at this happy crisis, to push forward into the harbor, not doubting I should receive protection either from a fort or some ship of force stationed there for the security of our fleet. As we stood up for Nantasket Road, an American battery opened upon us, which was the first serious proof we had that there could scarcely be many friends of ours at Boston. After each of the vessels had twice run aground, we anchored at George's Island and prepared for action. About 11 o'clock, four of the schooners anchored right upon our bow and one right astern of us. The armed brig took her station on our starboard side at the distance of 200 yards. It hailed us to strike the British flag. On our refusing to strike the British flag, the action was renewed with a good deal of warmth on both sides, and it was our misfortune, after the sharp combat of an hour and a half, to have expended every shot that we had for our artillery. Under such circumstances, hemmed in as we were with six privateers, in the middle of an enemy's harbor, beset with a dead calm, without the power of escaping, or even the most distant hope of relief, I thought it became my duty not to sacrifice the lives of gallant men wantonly in the arduous attempt of an evident impossibility." He goes on to say that he's being treated well in Boston and asked to be traded for an American officer as soon as possible.
On June 20th, 1774, John Adams pondered what his selection to the First Continental Congress would mean. "There is a new and a grand scene open before me, a Congress. This will be an assembly of the wisest men upon the continent who are Americans in principle, i.e. against the taxation of Americans by authority of the Parliament. I feel myself unequal to this business. A more extensive knowledge of the realm, the colonies, and of commerce, as well as of law and policy is necessary than I am master of. What can be done? Will it be expedient to propose an annual Congress of committees? To petition? Will it do to petition at all, to the King, to the Lords, to the Commons? What will such consultations avail? Deliberations alone will not do. We must petition, or recommend to the assemblies to petition."
Wednesday is June 21st. After the U.S. Supreme Court found that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, school districts across the American South were forcibly desegregated, sometimes in the face of massive white resistance, and sometimes only at bayonet point. Nearly two decades later, some in the North began to realize that while their local school districts didn't have de jure segregation, they were de facto segregated. Starting in 1961, a group of Boston parents, working with the Education Committee of the NAACP, began documenting the funding and enrollment disparities between black and white schools. In 1972, the NAACP filed a class action suit on behalf of 14 black parents in Boston. They alleged that the city had deliberately violated the 14th Amendment and had intentionally brought about and maintained racial segregation in the Boston public schools. A legal battle then wound its way through the state and federal courts and ended with a decision handed down by Judge Arthur Garrity on June 21, 1974. It is ordered and adjudged that the Boston School Committee and the Superintendent of Schools of the City of Boston, their officers, agents, servants, employees, attorneys, and all other persons in active concert or participation with them who receive actual notice of this judgment and order be permanently enjoined from discrimination upon the basis of race in the operation of the public schools of the City of Boston, and from creating, promoting, or maintaining racial segregation in any school or other facility in the Boston school system. And said defendants are further ordered to begin forthwith the formulation and implementation of plans which shall eliminate every form of racial segregation in the public schools of Boston, including all consequences and vestiges of segregation previously practiced by the defendants. The plans to eliminate segregation that the city came up with relied on busing, the practice of transporting kids from one neighborhood to another to racially integrate schools. Even today, over 60 years later, forced busing remains a divisive, inflammatory topic in Boston. Perhaps we'll need to dedicate a future episode to it.
As the Industrial Revolution began to get underway in America, the Merrimack River north of Boston became a major manufacturing center. It's a large river, carrying a huge volume of water from the White Mountains to the sea. Because it rapidly loses elevation as it flows through northern Massachusetts, dams would later be built that provided enormous amounts of power to the textile mills that drove the region's economy in the mid-19th century. However, that rapid elevation loss means that the river has rapids, and it wasn't navigable. Lumber from New Hampshire forests, granite from Chelmsford quarries, bark used to tan leather, and even farm products had to be driven to the port cities in ox carts. That all changed on June 22, 1793, when John Hancock signed a legislative act authorizing the Middlesex Canal. When it was completed in 1802, the canal connected Boston and Lowell, with extensions reaching from Concord, New Hampshire, to Haymarket Square in Boston. Ships of up to 75 feet long could carry 30 tons of cargo from Lowell to Boston in just 12 hours. An ox cart took days to make the same trip, carrying no more than 3 tons. Of course, after the steam engine was invented, a train could haul 300 tons at a time. When the Boston and Lowell Railroad opened in 1835, the canal's revenue dropped off sharply. It closed in 1853.
Friday is June 23rd, and there are some unbelievable quotes in this letter from a British officer on June 23rd, 1775, recounting his experience in the Battle of Bunker Hill. "Nothing can exceed the panic and apparent dislike of most of the king's troops to enter into this engagement. Even at the landing, several attempted to run away, and 5 actually took to their heels in order to join the Americans, but were presently brought back, and 2 of them were immediately hung as a deterrent to the rest. They, for the most part, openly express a dislike to the service in which they are engaged, and nothing but the fear of military punishment prevents their daily deserting. The provincials poured down like a torrent and fought like men who had no care for their persons. They disputed every inch of ground, and their numbers were far superior to ours. The king's troops gave way several times, and it required the utmost efforts of the generals to rally them. The engagement lasted upwards of 4 hours and ended infinitely to our disadvantage. The flower of our army are killed or wounded. Our troops are sickly, and a great number are afflicted with the scurvy, occasioned by the want of fresh provisions. I heartily wish myself with you and the rest of my friends, and the first opportunity that offers, I will sell out and return, for at the best, only disgrace can arise in the service of such a cause as that in which we are engaged. The Americans are not those poltroons I myself was once taught to believe them to be. They are men of liberal and noble sentiments. Their very characteristic is the love of liberty, and though I am an officer under the King of Great Britain, I tacitly admire their resolution and perseverance against the present oppressive measures of the British government." You know why those quotes are so unbelievable? Because they're made up. And we fell for it. When we tweeted lines from this letter a couple of years ago, local historian J.L. Bell kindly pointed out that this letter appeared only in the American press, had no name or detail around what unit the author served in, and included major details of the conflict, like the hangings, that don't appear in any other account. Fake news.
Samuel Sewell has made many appearances on the podcast in the past. We've referred to him as a witch trial judge, we've read his account of a Boston bread riot, and we learned that he was a curmudgeonly Puritan who hated Christmas. He was also one of the first Americans to articulate the idea of abolitionism. On June 24, 1700, Reverend Samuel Sewell published a pamphlet called The Selling of Joseph, in which he used chapter and verse from the Bible to argue that man-stealing, as he called it, was a grave sin. He makes his thesis plain from the start, saying, "For as much as liberty is in real value next unto life, none ought to part with it themselves or deprive others of it, but upon the most mature consideration. The numerousness of slaves at this day in the province, and the uneasiness of them under their slavery, hath put many upon thinking whether the foundation of it be firmly and well laid, so as to sustain the vast weight that is built upon it. It is most certain that all men, as they are the sons of Adam, are coheirs, and have equal right unto liberty and all other outward comforts of life." Then he goes on to refute many of the common defenses of slavery, point by point. Argument. Slaves are brought out of a pagan country into places where the gospel is preached. Answer. Evil must not be done that good may come of it. The extraordinary and comprehensive benefit accruing to the Church of God and to Joseph personally did not rectify his brethren's sale of him. Argument. The Africans have wars with one another. Our ships bring lawful captives taken in those wars. Answer. For aught is known, their wars are much such as were between Jacob's sons and their brother Joseph. If they be between town and town, provincial or national, every war is upon one side unjust. An unlawful war can't make lawful captives, and by receiving, we are in danger to promote and partake in their barbarous cruelties. I am sure if some gentleman should go down to the Brewsters to take the air and fish, and a stronger party from Hull should surprise them and sell them for slaves to a ship outward bound, they would think themselves unjustly dealt with, both by sellers and buyers. His arguments were unsuccessful, and slavery prevailed in Massachusetts until the 1780s, when it was ruled unconstitutional under the principles of liberty laid out by John Adams in our state constitution.
Finally, Sunday is June 25th. On June 25th, 1903, Boston celebrated a very special hooker day. No, not that kind of day. It was a grand celebration of General Joseph Fightin' Joe Hooker, commander of the Army of the Potomac during the Civil War. Hooker had been the highest-ranking general to come from Massachusetts during the war, and he was well-respected as an aggressive combat commander. Hooker Day was a chance for the general's old soldiers and the people of Massachusetts to celebrate Hooker with the unveiling of his statue in front of the Massachusetts State House. There were speeches by military leaders and the lieutenant governor, and the governor unveiled the statue. Then, it was time for the parade. As one news account put it, about 23,000 men formed in a line that required 2.5 hours to pass a given point. Following the mounted police came detachments from the regular Army of the United States, rumbling artillery, cavalry, and company after company of infantry, with the quick step and accurate formation that show the trained soldier. Battalions of the Marine Corps were followed by the seamen from the battleships Texas, Indiana, and Hartford. Then came the governor, mounted on a superb black horse. Cheers follow him as the lines move on. After him came 6 regiments of Massachusetts militia with accompanying battalions of state cavalry, artillery, and 2 corps of cadets. Then came a spectacle where pathos and lofty enthusiasm were wonderfully blended. Company after company of the veterans of the Great Civil War, Hooker's old command. What a roar of applause goes up at the sight of the tattered flags borne by the old color bearers. How real history becomes. We can almost see that army as it marched away to battle 40 years ago. But now the lines are thinner, the step less firm. We know that we are looking on one of the last marches of that army, which honors a leader today. Then comes the dignitaries in the carriages, and the applause of the crowd follows them. Then, more veterans. Among them, 2 carriages of those who fought in the Mexican War. What a salute they receive! The ancient and honorable artillery company and the fusiliers make a bright division in their showy uniforms. And lastly comes 3 regiments of the Boston School Cadet Brigade. And all this long procession punctuated at frequent intervals with drum corps and bands, which ceased not to swell the national strain. Truly, it was a sight to be remembered.
Now let's turn to our main topic, Joseph Warren. History has been kind to colonial Boston's patriot leaders. John Adams, Paul Revere, John Hancock, Samuel Adams. These are household names almost 250 years later. But Dr. Warren has faded somewhat, though he was a central figure in the political churning that led to the Revolution. Born in Roxbury in 1741, he was a graduate of Harvard College by age 18. To learn more about his extracurricular activities with the grave-digging Spunkers Club, listen to our episode 30. By the age of 22, he was the youngest doctor in Boston. His patients included Samuel Adams, John Hancock, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, as well as prominent loyalists, including the children of Royal Governor Thomas Hutchinson and British General Thomas Gage. Outside of his medical practice, Dr. Warren was an active Mason. He would eventually be appointed Grand Master of the newly established Provincial Grand Lodge of Massachusetts in 1769. Through his profession and his Masonic duties, Joseph Warren developed a vast personal network that would serve him well when he became involved in politics. He became a member of the Sons of Liberty and the Committee of Correspondence, and he was appointed president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, the highest position in the revolutionary government. Any one of his accomplishments could be its own episode, but we'll try to keep it to a highlight reel. In February of 1770, Warren conducted an autopsy on the body of 11-year-old Christopher Sider. On February 22nd, Sider had joined a crowd ransacking the house of Ebenezer Richardson, a customs service employee who had tried to disperse a protest in front of loyalist merchant Theophilus Lilly's shop. The crowd threw stones, which broke Richardson's windows and struck his wife. Richardson tried to scare them away by firing a gun into the crowd. Sider was wounded in the arm and chest and died that evening. Samuel Adams arranged for the funeral, which over 2,000 people attended. Warren's autopsy confirmed the obvious, that Sider had been killed by gunshot wound. This pronouncement and the large public funeral leveraged Bostonian outrage that boiled over with the Boston Massacre just 11 days later. 2 years later, on March 5th, 1772, Warren gave a speech to commemorate the anniversary of the Boston Massacre with a closing that stirred the heart of every patriot. "The voice of your father's blood cries to you from the ground. My sons scorn to be slaves. In vain we met the frowns of tyrants. In vain we crossed the boisterous ocean, found a new world, and prepared it for the happy residents of liberty. In vain we toiled. In vain we fought. We bled in vain if you, our offspring, want valor to repel the assaults of her invaders. Stain not the glory of your worthy ancestors, but like them resolve never to part with your birthright. Be wise in your deliberations, and determined in your exertions for the preservation of your liberties. Follow not the dictates of passion, but enlist yourselves under the sacred banner of reason. Use every method in your power to secure your rights. At least prevent the curses of posterity from being heaped upon your memories. If you, with united zeal and fortitude, oppose the torrent of oppression, if you feel the true fire of patriotism burning in your breasts, if you from your souls despise the most gaudy dress that slavery can wear, if you really prefer the lonely cottage, whilst blessed with liberty, to gilded palaces surrounded with the ensigns of slavery, you may have the fullest assurance that tyranny, with her accursed train, will hide their hideous heads in confusion, shame, and despair. If you perform your part, you must have the strongest confidence that the same almighty being who protected your pious and venerable forefathers, who enabled them to turn a barren wilderness into a fruitful field, who so often made bare his arms for their salvation, will still be mindful of you, their offspring."
Warren drafted the Suffolk Resolves on September 6, 1774. The resolves were issued in response to a convention of the Committees of Correspondence for Suffolk, Middlesex, Essex, and Worcester counties, held on August 26 and 27. Held at Faneuil Hall, the committees met to strategize a response to the recent Massachusetts Government Act, which had disenfranchised citizens of Massachusetts by revoking key provisions of the Provincial Charter of 1691. In a display of spite that warms my heart, the convention urged all Massachusetts counties to close their courts rather than submit to the oppressive measure. As each county, in turn, closed its court, it issued a set of resolves to explain its actions. The Suffolk resolves were unique in that the document was formally endorsed by the Continental Congress. As with the other county resolves, the Suffolk document denounced the intolerable acts, or coercive acts, that had recently been passed by the British Parliament, and specifically resolved to... Number 1. Boycott British imports, curtail exports, and refuse to use British products. Number 2. Pay no obedience to the Massachusetts Government Act or the Boston Port Bill. Number 3. Demand resignations from those appointed to positions under the Massachusetts Government Act. Number 4. Refuse payment of taxes until the Massachusetts Government Act was repealed. Number 5. Support a colonial government in Massachusetts free of royal authority until the intolerable acts were repealed. And number 6. Urge the colonies to raise militia of their own people. Paul Revere delivered a copy of the resolves to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, where it was endorsed on September 17th as a show of colonial solidarity. In response, John Adams commented in his diary, "This was one of the happiest days of my life. In Congress, we had generous, noble sentiments and manly eloquence. This day convinced me that America will support Massachusetts or perish with her." Fast forward 6 months to the spring of 1775, when Warren's network of intelligence revealed the British Army's intent to move on Concord and Lexington. Perhaps his greatest contribution to the Patriot cause was his fateful decision to dispatch Paul Revere and William Dawes. By this time, British troops had been policing Boston for 6.5 years, and in April of that year, there was a sense that things must be coming to a boil. John Hancock and Samuel Adams had emerged as known Patriot leaders, and their profile in Boston was too high to go on living safely in the city. And so they moved their headquarters to a parsonage in Lexington. On April 16th, there was a lot of movement among the troops encamped on the common. Boats were being moved around, the grenadiers were massing. Clearly, something big was in the works. Warren's spy network had been aware that something was happening. He had just been waiting to learn the soldiers' route before warning Hancock and Adams, the presumed targets, of a raid on the countryside. On April 18th, when the soldiers started marching down to the foot of the common to board longboats and row across the Back Bay to Cambridge, Warren was ready to dispatch his messengers, Paul Revere and William Dawes. Dawes took the land route, the only road leading off the peninsula of Boston, where he got past a military checkpoint by posing as a drunk farmer who had stayed at the market a little too long.
"Officer, I simply must get home to my wife."
Revere departed from the North End, rowing across the mouth of the river to Charlestown. Both endeavors were very risky, and so Revere planned a backup for himself. He prearranged a signal with a fellow patriot in Charlestown. If the troops were marching by land, one lantern would hang in the tower of Old North. If they were rowing across the Charles, two.
Two lanterns it was. After a night with dozens of riders traveling throughout Middlesex County, warning that the regulars were coming out, Warren slipped out of Boston early in the morning of the 19th. After the battles at Concord and Lexington, he coordinated and led militia as they chased and fired on the British Army during its retreat to Boston. During this fighting, Warren had a near miss. He got shot in the wig by a musket ball, which you can imagine must have given him a great story to dine out on. His mother, however, was not impressed. She urged him to keep his head down and consider his safety. With eloquence, he replied, "Where danger is, dear mother, there must your son be. Now is no time for any of America's children to shrink from any hazard. I will set her free or die." After his valiant efforts that day, Warren was appointed a major general in the newly formed Army of Observation. With the British now under siege in Boston, the Patriot Army needed cannons to give them the leverage needed to force an evacuation. Within weeks, Captain Benedict Arnold informed Warren and the Massachusetts Committee of Safety that 80 cannons could be taken from the lightly guarded Fort Ticonderoga. Warren again sets the course of history by authorizing the operation, and Fort Ticonderoga's cannons were easily captured and then transported to Boston, where their installation on Dorchester Heights led to a March 17, 1776 evacuation of the city. Before the cannons arrived from Ticonderoga, Joseph Warren played a key role at the Battle of Bunker Hill on June 17, 1775. Rather than let the title of Major General go to his head, he insisted that other men had more experience as battle leaders and chose to fight as a private. Early in the day, he said, These fellows say we won't fight. By heaven, I hope I shall die up to my knees in blood. Spoiler alert, he did. He asked to be sent to the location where the heaviest fighting was expected, and he dedicated himself to raising the spirits of the troops, inspiring men to hold the rank against superior numbers. He fought until ammunition ran out, and remained until the British made their third and final assault on the hill. In that final attack, he was killed instantly by a musket ball, hit in the face by a British officer who recognized him. He was so despised by the enemy that his body was stripped of clothing, he was bayoneted in the face until unrecognizable, and then he was shoved into a shallow ditch. British Captain Walter Laurie, who had been defeated at Old North Bridge and Concord, later said he stuffed the scoundrel with another rebel into one hole, and there he and his seditious principles may remain. In a letter to John Adams, Benjamin Hitchborn describes the damage that British Lieutenant James Drew inflicted on Warren's body 2 days after the Battle of Bunker Hill. In a day or two after, Drew went upon the hill again, opened the dirt that was thrown over Dr. Warren, spit in his face, jumped on his stomach, and at last cut off his head and committed every act of violence upon his body.
So that was burial number one. But a mass grave on Bunker Hill was not an appropriate resting place for a revolutionary hero. 10 months later, on April 6, 1776, his friends went looking for him. At that point, it was nearly impossible to identify the remains of anyone, even without the excessive bayoneting. But as luck would have it, Paul Revere was able to identify the remains by recognizing his own dentistry work, wiring, and an artificial tooth. The body was recognized from the circumstance that the left upper cuspidatus, or eye tooth, had been secured in its place by a golden wire. For any dentists who are listening, this is the first recorded instance of post-mortem identification by forensic odontology. Warren was then moved to the Granary Burying Ground for his second burial. Abigail Adams described that burial in a letter to John dated April 10th. The doctor was buried on Monday, the masons walking in procession from the state house, with the military in uniforms and a large concourse of people attending. He was carried into the chapel, and there a funeral dirge was played, an excellent prayer by Dr. Cooper, and an oration by Mr. Morton, which I hope will be printed. I think the subject must have inspired him. A young fellow could not have wished for a finer opportunity to have displayed his talents. The amiable and heroic virtues of the deceased recent in the minds of the audience, the noble cause to which he fell a martyr, their own sufferings and unparalleled injuries all freshened their minds, must give weight and energy to whatever could be delivered upon the occasion. The dead body, like that of Caesar's before their eyes.
He was again moved to St. Paul's Church, just about a block away in 1825. An 1874 Masonic biography notes, "After the funeral ceremonies, the remains were deposited in a tomb in the Granary Burying Ground, where they remained for nearly 50 years, and the place of deposit was forgotten. In 1825, the laying of the cornerstone of Bunker Hill Monument revived the memory of General Warren and prompted a long search for his ashes, which was successful. They were identified, as in the previous exhumation, by the left upper eye tooth, which had been secured in its place by a golden wire, and by the mark of the fatal bullet behind the left ear. The sacred relics were carefully collected, deposited in a box of hard wood, designated by a silver plate, and placed in the Warren tomb under St. Paul's Church." The fourth and final burial took place on August 3rd, 1855, where the remains were moved to the new Warren tomb at Forest Hill Cemetery, where you can visit him today. His grandnephew, Dr. Jonathan Mason Warren, described the burial in a journal entry dated May 6, 1859. "The remains of General Joseph Warren were removed from St. Paul's to Forest Hills on August 3, 1855, when my father, Dr. John Collins Warren, Sullivan, William Appleton, and myself put them into a stone or earthen urn like those of John Warren, Mrs. Warren, and my mother. The place was quite moist where they were put, and the hole in the head of General Warren was becoming enlarged by the crumbling of the margin. I had a photograph made of it in three positions."
If you'd like to learn more about Joseph Warren's life, death, and four grave sites, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/033. We'll have a link to the full text of Warren's 1772 Boston Massacre oration, and to historian Samuel Forman's online repository of all things Joseph Warren. We'll link to a webcomic called The Dreamer that features Joseph and John Warren, and a link to 1856 photographs of Warren's skull, revealing conclusively that he was shot while facing the enemy. A link to the full text of the Suffolk Resolves, Trumbull's The Death of Joseph Warren, and an app to help you find our other Founding Fathers' graves in the Granary Burying Ground. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. After we released our podcast last week about the serial killer who called himself the Giggler, a listener named Joe reminded me that there was a minor character in the Charles Bronson movie Death Wish 3 called the Giggler. He was a pickpocket who would giggle as he stole your stuff, who Charles Bronson, of course, murdered.
They killed the Giggler, man. They killed the Giggler!
They had no business doing that. None.
Our old friend Alexander Hamilton, at the A. Ham, weighed in on the Giggler as well, saying, "The 911 call was chilling. You were right, I knew of the Boston Strangler, but not the Giggler."
If you want us to feature your favorite, lesser-known story, email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It's the best way to help others find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week with a show about Boston and the Golden Age of Piracy. Arr, matey!